Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is John McMurtry. It's good to have John back. John, of course, is a very distinguished professor emeritus. John, your credentials are so voluminous. He's written volumes on philosophy and world problems. He has written books that we've mentioned on this program before. He'll have a new edition of his Cancer Stage of Capitalism available. His other important books include Unequal Freedoms, Value Wars. We've had marvelous discussions with John on this program. I always look forward to when John will come back on again. Before we begin, John, let me just make a couple of comments. I'll have an opportunity later on Press TV this afternoon to discuss the situation in Syria, which is absolutely deplorable, with a chemical weapons hoax going on against the Syrian government. It has absolutely not used chemical weapons, but the so-called rebels, these death squads that were recruited by Washington and other Western countries and complicit regional allies, they absolutely have used chemical weapons. They've been trained to use them by Pentagon operatives, either special service forces and Pentagon contractors, literally getting chemical weapons in the hands of these people, training them on their use, and they're using them. I mean, why else would you train people to use chemical weapons if you didn't want them to use them? Well, I think it's worse than that. I think they're not only getting the training, the special forces, CIA, whatever, are picking targets and directing these people to use chemical weapons against civilians or whoever, and then blame it on Assad. So the accusation that the Assad government is using this is absolutely fabricated and bonus. But, you know, it's WMD's Iraq all over again. One more comment, John. Tomorrow I'll put out an article on the new president, the president-elect of Iran, Hassan Rouhani. John, I researched him this morning, and I wrote an article about it, and I'll put it out tomorrow. It's a very simple, direct title. It's Hassan Rouhani, Iran's president-elect. I was really surprised and delighted at how remarkable a man he seems to be. He's been very active politically, diplomatically, and he's a scholar. He's written many books, many articles, many research papers, and his record goes, he's about 64 years old, so he's not a kid. He began as a teenager studying religious studies. He got a degree at Tehran University. He did graduate work at Glasgow University in Scotland, and he's been very active in Iran since at least the 1980s. So it's going on 30, 35 years or so since the Iranian Revolution. During the time of the Shah, he was very critical of repression that went on during that horrible generation. So now he's elected. Iranians are very, very happy about it. There were six candidates. There were eight to begin with. For reasons they didn't explain that I saw, two of them dropped out, so six competed. And of the six, Rouhani got nearly 51% of the vote. He got three times the vote count of his nearest rival, so he really won overwhelmingly. In America, you'd call that a landslide. Well, I wish him well. I'm very, very concerned, John, about what's going to happen going forward, because in my article, I quote a White House statement that's very hostile. I quote a statement from Israel's foreign ministry and from Prime Minister Netanyahu. Well, what else would you expect from them but absolutely belligerent, hostile comments? Doesn't make a damn bit of difference, they basically said, whether it's Rouhani or anybody else. So you can see the way the daggers are drawn and the challenges that he'll face when he takes office on the 3rd of August. That will be his inauguration today. Thanks. John, welcome.
Well, it's good to be back, Steve. I hadn't heard about the Iran thing. That is rather very interesting. I mean, there's, you know, the problem of the candidates being reduced to a certain number that pass the selection test, 1,200 pass the selection test of the really a theocratic regime. But from what you're saying, this seems to be a remarkable person indeed. From like 51% of the vote out of six candidates, it's interesting that he wasn't even mentioned, so far as I could see, by anybody as an issue or as a hope of any sort. But if 51% of the people vote for somebody who's only one out of six, that indicates he has a lot of popular support. And then what you're giving, you know, his background, I'm especially impressed by the fact that he fought against the Shah. Like, that was one of the great tragedies of history, really, was where we had this liberation movement. Of course, it began back in 1953 with Mazen Deg. A social democratic government was elected, but he said he was going to nationalize oil, which it is in oil. You know, all oil or subsoil assets are national property. It's just in accordance with international law, and he was going to make that a fact as well as in principle law. And, of course, the usual happened. The U.S., who's, you know, guided, as we know, solely by its oil and banking interests, overthrew the democratic government of Mossadegh, and then went into the Shah, who was himself a construction, and then the Shah was a brutal dictator under Sadat, a torturer who was infamous around the world. And these, by the way, I was there when the Shah was in power. They wouldn't report when the king of Afghanistan broke his leg, because I was staying with journalists in Tehran, because kings don't break legs. So you were really dealing with a kind of a medieval mindset ruling there, though under the name of a so-called secular construction, a so-called Shah, king of kings, Shana Shah. So it's a pretty absurd situation that's been installed there. And then again a rebellion happens, and I was part of that. I don't know whether you remember it. I was at Berkeley, California at the time when the uprisings against the Shah were happening across the world. And we had a liberation movement, a secular liberation movement, again, like the first liberation movement. But that seems to be the one thing that is will not be acceptable, is a democratic social government that's going to look out for the people's common interests. Better by far to have the theocracy that we have, the mullah rule we have, as long as it doesn't claim social ownership over the resources of oil. But of course it does that too. But it's a backward regime, and it has been forced into power really because of the way in which all possible, and this happened across, excuse me, the Middle East. I've been through all the countries of the Middle East, and I was through them in the 1960s, and in that period, they were all secular socialist, what was called Arab socialist societies, and very popular. And religion really wasn't part of the issue. I mean, there was, you know, Islam was like here, like Christianity here or the like. It was the religion of the people, but it wasn't really basic to conversations and discussions of what was going on. That has all been brought about by the oil and banking empire, the cancer system that we know today. And so hopefully that will have a better result. But as you say, it's predictable, isn't it? It's just like a deck of cards, watching it all fall out the same way. And right next door in Iraq, which of course had been engineered into war with Iran in the past, but now they're very friendly. With Syria happening, all the people, they're pouring over the border into Syria, outside forces, as you say. They're trained by special forces, and they're financed by the Gulf as well as by NATO. But they have become a jihadist movement themselves. It's just another jihadist movement. But that shouldn't surprise us, because all the jihadist movements have, in fact, their origins in the U.S. construction and secret financing, building, direction, arming and direction by NATO and U.S.-led NATO special forces. And so we have this comical here the U.S. is above all concerned about jihadi terrorists and above all concerned to protect our security against them, and on the story goes, while in fact all the while sponsoring them, financing them, arming them to make mayhem. And you might say, well, that doesn't make any sense at all. It's pure unreason. The whole strategy of this system is to destabilize countries and split them up so that they're easy pickings. So it doesn't matter what the outcome is. You know, you might say, well, they, you know, failed in Iraq. Well, it didn't fail. We got control of the oil there. It's failed in Syria because we still haven't, you know, the U.S. Puppets haven't taken over Syria yet. Well, I mean, they've got Syria in a completely weakened position, and they've got the world screaming for blood. And the irony of all ironies is over sarin gas attacks. Well, I can hardly believe my ears when I hear this over and over again said, not only through the New York Times and the other organs with which you're so familiar, but through our own public broadcasting system here in Canada, where it's the regime that's being accused of the gas attacks, which are illegal as chemical weapons under international law. Well, that's a good thing. But the fact that the sarin gas attacks, the United Nations investigators themselves, the former chief prosecutor for the International Criminal Court at The Hague, De La Ponte, she has said there is strong, concrete evidence.
Indeed so.
The UN itself has reported that nerve gas has been used by the rebels. And then you're further adding, not only used by the rebels, but supplied to the rebels by the forces that are screaming and yelling against it.
She got her ears boxed, John. She then had a waffle and pulled back and said, we really aren't sure who's using these things or exactly what chemicals are being used. So, I mean, she waffled under very heavy pressure. But
well, they got her to zip her mouth is what they did.
Well,
and,
exactly.
You know, and that's the sort of power of these, you know, it happens at every level. I mean, just what comes to mind, the World Health Organization, for example, has long wanted, for 20 years, wanted to do something about this disease epidemic of obesity and junk foods, okay, because it's the world's number one health problem. It's become bigger than cancer. And they just want to put facts on packages that carry a lot of the junk that causes obesity, that causes diabetes most fatally of all and most frequently, which, you know, means your legs get lopped off in the end, or such horrible outcome, and which has happened to a very dear friend of mine. So they're not allowed to do that. So anytime the U.S. says stop it, then the UN jumps to attention. I mean, I've mentioned to you, I've written Philosophy and World Problems. Freudian slip there. The problems are programmed. For UNESCO, a multi-volume work, and in that process, I don't know whether it's because of the work that I did, but it was, you know, very, very in encyclopedia. It was for their Encyclopedia of Life Support Systems. They've just pulled all funding from UNESCO, the U.S. So anything that they don't like, they just pull the funding from, and that includes the International Criminal Court. So we have the criminal court, and she's actually on the panel of the investigators, and she has this evidence, and then of course further evidence you're pointing out. Well, the way it's just disappeared, the evidence. It's just like a show trial. You disappear the evidence, and you go through the always. This is always the mode. You first of all, I mean, I might even say it's a law-like mode. These are the laws of the system, as, if you will, big lie terror. The first is false denial of all claims against one. Always. There'll always be a false denial. It doesn't matter whether it's the private sector or the government sector or whatever. That's just this automatic thing. It's a false denial. That's law-like. That's predictable. That's what they always do, try to find an exception. Then the next operation, which has fascinated me as somebody who's interested in cognitive mechanics, the next operation is reverse projection, and I've often spoken about that on this program. Reverse projection is that you blame the other side for what you, in fact, are doing or are about to do, and you use that blame as the reason for attacking them. That is, they are doing what you are doing, you claim, as the grounds for invading or attacking them. That reverse projection method, operation, is automatic now. It's just as automatic as the false denial. As the false denial goes in, then the reverse projection goes on. And then you say, well, the mess that's left out of all this, because everything's topsy-turvy, we don't know, it's an Orwellian universe of unmeaning where everything is contradicts itself. It makes no sense at all. Well, it does in terms of the geophysical or the geostrategic payoff matrix they're after, which is we want all the resources and the military outposts and the markets and whatever else is of value in that society to keep on growing, to keep on globalizing this global cancer, money sequence cancer system. And so that's also predictable. That's what they're going to do. And it doesn't matter if they don't, as it were, win the war. As long as that society is completely destabilized, like, say, Somalia, it's been going on for 25 years, or that they will be so weak and they're incapable of defending their own interests. And once they're incapable of defending their own interests, it's only a matter of time, whether it's like the Congo or whether it's another form, it's only a matter of time where all their resources and so forth fall to your control. This is going on in Europe right now, and it's all the same mechanisms that are being used that we're used to in the South. What's happening with Greece is that everything connects, of course. What's happening is Greece has, you know, discovered a huge amount of oil off in the Ionian Sea, a huge amount of oil, which more than covers its bad debts. That's never brought into the discussion, but it's known about and has been known about for some time. It hasn't been exploited yet. What is the reason why it's not being exploited is that through the debt deficit machine mechanism that they have of breaking countries on the wheel, and that's the favorite mechanism, debt deficits, you know, where the money is invented by Wall Street, 97% of it's coined by Wall Street or the other bank, the rest of the banking system, doesn't have the money to back the loans it makes, but it demands compound interest loans on them forever. And that's what Greece has been caught into and suckered into every which way. And so that then, that asset of theirs, the oil, then falls to the control of the Western banking system as they're unable to pay their debts. So this is all a way of getting Greece's oil. And which you never, of course, ever hear anywhere any more than you don't even hear that all the money they owe the banks, the only people who are being helped out on this, the only people who are being rescued or bailed out are the banks themselves, the private foreign banks themselves are the only ones who are being rescued by this thing, the only same people who are being paid by this thing. Nothing, not a cent ever goes through the actual public interests of the people. So you just let that drag on and drag on and drag on, and then when you get you then have control over the oil. Then Turkey comes into the picture. Turkey's a new player. You know, since it's 2001, it had a collapse in 2001 under IMF direction, the usual story, where everything goes wrong, and they still have 48% of their people living at the poverty line or below, but they've made a lot of strides forward, which means there's been a lot of enrichment of the rich. And so we have Turkey now getting militant and talking in the manner of an Ottoman Empire and a reclaimed, renewed Ottoman Empire. And of course, they want that oil because it's in the sea between them and Greece, and they're making claims on the oil. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw Turkey making belligerent noises about getting claiming that oil, and I wouldn't even be surprised if they were suckered into an attack on Greece so that they themselves can be put in place, just as we've seen across the Arab world. these uprisings, they've always happened from, which I've only learned by investigating each one. What binds all the uprisings together is that those societies from Egypt to Syria or wherever you want to go have all been neoliberalized. Well, of course, neoliberalized is hardly an adequate term for it, and I'd like to actually get into that meaning. They've all been neoliberalized. They've all had these, the usual thing happen where everything gets privatized, the public sector gets eliminated, the labor loses its jobs, there's deregulation. You point them out very well in a recent article by you. All these things happen. They happen everywhere. They happen in Canada. They happen in the U.S. They happen everywhere. It's one big transnational money sequence cancer system, and that's what binds everything together. And so this is running its course in variations on the one theme everywhere, and you try to find an exception in any one of these countries where the countries aren't having an uprising because of a lot of dispossession that has occurred from the private transnational money sequence system overrunning everything and to multiply itself. Try to find one place that that hasn't happened already, that they aren't seeking to resist it, and that it in fact is being turned to the advantage of the very program, the very transnational money sequence system that is destroying it. And that everything falls out in accordance with that pattern, and it's predictable. I mean, I'm predicting that's the way what will continue to happen, and as with any scientific hypothesis, we then await to see whether, in fact, it does happen, or is there any disconfirming evidence here. As long as they can succeed in their geostrategic method, and the minimum that is left over is a country that's destroyed and easy pickings. So it is, in all manners, a world cancer system.
John, there's no question it's a world cancer system. I must tell you, I was not familiar with the oil and where there's oil, there's gas reserves, I guess, in the Aegean Sea.
Yeah, where there's gas, there's oil.
Man. Oh, absolutely. It is, there can be more of one than the other, but it's there. And if it's in the Aegean Sea, there could be multiple deposits, because what usually happens is when they find oil, they need to drill multiple wells. And Turkey and Greece are separated on either side by the Aegean Sea.
Yeah.
So I can see a little battle going on. The dirty part of what you're talking, well, one of the dirty parts of what you're talking about, John, is the Greek government is very willing to go along with these corporate predators and the central bank predators to literally steal the resources of the country. I mean, they'll steal them on land. I don't know what you can steal in the air except for air rights, and they're going to steal the resources beneath the water.
Well, the air is occupied by the pollution. I mean, it's stolen already. It may be the biggest theft of all, clean air.
Oh, for sure, for sure.
As always, these countries have got, I mean, yeah, I've been to pretty well all of them, and I can hardly breathe the air in the city. I mean, I get sick, sometimes very sick from just being unable to breathe the air.
It's a horrible situation, John. The end of the human race, John, could either end up in a mushroom-shaped cloud or the environmental disaster ecocide, and that takes longer than the mushroom-shaped cloud.
It's in a slow-motion collapse as we speak. And, of course, nothing is being done about it. Every single thing that goes wrong just becomes another site for money sequence cancer multiplication. For example, green energy has just turned into one big trough for large multinational corporations to feed at the public expense on all sorts of big industrial schemes for green, so-called green energy, which is not green at all. It never works. It's a huge industrial installation that makes much money for its installers. And it always displaces, in one way or another, displaces human life and makes, in fact, whether it's a dam or these giant industrial turbines, which, by the way, don't work. They use 70% as much oil as oil-driven or fossil fuel-driven mechanisms. So we have, this is what I long ago referred to in unequal freedoms, and it caught the attention of some people as a little grim sounding, but I called it the death spiral. And the death spiral is when the system goes into breakdown mode, it uses the occasions of its breakdowns as new opportunities for profit at public expense, even more profit at even more public expense than the problem they already caused. And the death spiral means it's spiraling down, and each time we come to another threshold breaking in the system, whether it's of energy supply or air or access to clean water, whatever it is, then you're going to have yet another super exploitation of that zone, that region, to make things much worse, but much more profitable and much more at public expense, because the public pays through the nose for all of it. They're now getting control of the water. Wall Street says, and I quote directly from the chief economist of Citibank, he says water is the single most important physical-based commodity asset class, far more valuable than oil and gas and all the precious metals put together. They're after water now. They're after the world's water. Well, how can they get that? They just bet on the futures of it, because it's all, you know, everything's been put into motion as a future asset that you can make bids and claims on, and with money you don't have, because all of these derivatives have no money to back them. And so you buy one way or another. You buy the future prices of these necessities that people cannot do without. And of course, they've done it with housing. We see what happens there. Now they've done it with food. We see what happens there. The prices go up. People starve and are malnourished, and Wall Street gets richer still. And now they're doing it big time with water. Rio+20 had as its chief planner a Wall Street banker. And they're telling everybody, oh, we're going to bring the money that you need in order to make this secure and available to all, et cetera, all the usual lies. It always begins with great big lies. And what they do is they control the prices. And so forever after, they're going to be putting up the price in order to maximize their returns. And as always, they never pay any attention to the infrastructure they buy. It's just good as an asset to pump out money for as long as it lasts. They destroy the basis of provision at the same time, which always requires actual people on the ground who need the water, but they aren't going to be able to afford the prices, and they fight back at the level of direct ownership. But what hasn't been understood, that the whole game has shifted now to the virtual realm of buying futures, and that the world's whole means of life supply is being bought out now as fast as they can buy it out, with no money involved, no real legal tender required for a cent of it. But they've got it set up so that they can buy these futures with nothing and thus continue winding the death. Really, it's a terrible thing to say, but keep the death spiral downwards going. So we have, at the same time, people rebelling all over the place. They don't quite understand what's gone wrong. Almost no theorist seems to... there's only one diagnostic model that fits, but almost nobody dares speak it. And we have a situation which is... we're becoming... Well, you always look for hope, don't you? And so, going back to Syria in this round, you have been really courageous on this Syria thing. You, from the beginning, I didn't hear anybody else really yelling it from the rooftops, but you were, about what this Syria adventure is and who backs it and the terrible aspects of terrorists. It's pure terrorism. And of course, the irony, you know, the reverse projection of terrorists onto those who are the victims of your terror, and it is sheer terror. They haven't gone into Syria. And I wouldn't underestimate the power of your voice, for example, to simply just be calling it out all the time. Never let up. You never let up. You don't let a day go by that you aren't reporting on it. And that's the only way things actually change for the better, is that eventually people awake at least to a splinter of the problem, but it's still a very important one, and maybe this Syria thing is coming a cropper. But right now, it looks like they're making that last, you know, when they repeat all the old big lies, when they're perfectly aware that it's a jihadist group that are the dominant group on the ground, along with their special forces, NATO advisors. It's a mayhem of stream of people coming across the border from Iraq, and then from there coming from Iran and coming from Lebanon and everywhere. It's just a black war zone that's being constructed again as we speak. Even when we have found that the sarin nerve gas comes from the opposition, that was the first thing that was said, and they've just buried it. Even though there's no doubt that the whole thing has been ordered by special and organized by and financed by special forces, NATO special forces to begin with. Even though the whole mechanism of resistance there is obviously not a popular resistance at all. It's completely foreign sponsored and is about opposed to our claim of democratic interests as it could possibly be. So it's one rolls with the Orwellian roll of it, you know, and I'm just hoping that, nevertheless, they won't go in there. They know, and this is the thing that will eventually beat this system, is that it is a failure. I'll leave it at that.
Oh, indeed, John. So many important comments. Let's take a quick break, and you can hold your thought, and we'll pick right back up when we come back. On with John McMurtry. John, I love it when you come on because we cover a wide variety of issues, and there are so many. We've got them abroad, we've got them domestically, in Canada, in America. I'll be discussing Syria in an hour or so on Press TV. I'm very concerned about what's going on, and I can just smell it, John. I've been smelling it for so long, and it's very similar in strategy. The tactics change in all the post-9/11 wars, but the strategy is the same. Yeah. So in Afghanistan and Iraq, we had bombings and we had invasions and occupations, and they're still ongoing. Iraq is very much occupied. America has 3 or 4 super bases. U.S. forces are there, CIA contractors, the rest of it. Iraq is an occupied country. It's going to stay occupied.
Yeah.
And the same is true for Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And the situation in Libya was a proxy death squad, foot soldiers, with a U.S.-led NATO air force. So far in Syria, it's the same thing in Libya without the Air Force so far, but it looks like we're heading for it. And this no-fly zone, mumbo-jumbo, that is a declaration of war. It is an absolute declaration of war. And a U.S. general explained to John better than I could on the Libya situation. And he said General Hamm, who headed AFRICOM, I believe, said if that is instituted, we have to take out command and control and ground defenses. got to prevent the Gaddafi government from shooting down NATO aircraft. Yeah. Well, whatever he was able to, whatever defenses he had, they were nothing compared to what Syria had. So you stick in a no-fly zone, we're really heading for something big.
Yeah, that, I agree with you, Steve. That's the most chilling terrorist news I've heard for weeks on this one. The no-fly zone. It's just the same, just like an echo chamber. Here it comes again. Same reasons, same lies, same reverse projections, same takeover, same destruction. You know,
and John,
with the whole thing, though,
John,
you know.
John, one quick comment. Yeah. It's worse this time than Libya because technically the Security Council can authorize this, even though it never should do it. It will not happen through the Security Council this time because Russia and China won't let it. They were burned in Libya, and they're not going to be burned again. So Washington will just do it extrajudiciously without the Security Council.
Using perhaps Turkish aircraft.
Turkey, Jordan, and Israel border on Syria,
yeah.
And America has air bases in Turkey. I don't know what they have in Jordan, but they have troops there, and they certainly have facilities in Israel. And I think whatever happens, Israel is going to be a positive.
Under that cover, and it's just on that front, you know, so that it'll look local for the very reason you're saying. The whole thing, Steve, that really connects, everything connects, and it connects, and it's just like, you know, it keeps unraveling and unraveling all the connections. And at the same time we're hearing all this, we're hearing and we're seeing the third great hero of the knowledge economy, the true knowledge economy, the true information economy, Edward Snowden, after Bradley Manning, after Schwartz, Aaron Schwartz. We have three young, all guys under 30, all amazingly capable, amazingly talented people, and all representing the best of America's soul, and perhaps even more overwhelming to an observer is their courage. And why are they being so attacked? I don't need to go. You've gone into it, and I'm sure the program has heard, but that they are being attacked as if they're the worst possible criminals. They're being called traitors and treasonous by the Democrat leaders like Dianne Feinstein themselves. They're living in either being hunted down like animals or living in, as Bradley Manning, that young, beautiful hero, who just, all he wanted to do was expose what actually is going on. That's the reason everybody's giving. They just want to expose what's actually going on, because once people know what is actually going on, as opposed to the big lies, the reverse projections, etc., then they cannot go on supporting it. So this is the reason why they're coming down so hard on these people, because otherwise you can go on calling the big lie no matter how outrageous it is, and there's no other information to disconfirm it. These guys are of the greatest danger, as education and knowledge is always of the greatest danger to tyrannies, and especially a cancerous tyranny. Because that's the very nature of cancer, is that it evades the detection of the immunological survey mechanism of the host life system. It evades its detection. This is the turning point of the cancer. When the body recognizes what's actually going on, who is actually invading it, who is actually multiplying itself with no committed life function and destroying everything in its path merely to make more of itself with no function, no production, nothing but grabbing more still. They lie on the information edge of exposing it. And so they are in yet another level of Syria, right inside the U.S. And it all connects. And so I think we should at the same time recognize, the heroic work. Like, what gives me hope for is the civilization itself, with people like that. You know, there's hope. Because they've sacrificed everything in order to do this. And they are right. It's at that level, the knowledge and information, no level that the system will break. It's John, the only level I can.
John, we really see America descending down to the depths that so many tyrannical societies have taken in the past. And it literally can happen anywhere. Weimar Germany, a democratic republic, whether it was perfect or not, I mean, it was transformed into Nazi Germany. There were hard times. There were reasons why it happened. And there were outside powers that helped bring Hitler to power. The situation in Chile under Salvador Allende, the Chilean government might have been the most democratic in the hemisphere.
It was perhaps the most popular government in the world.
Yeah.
Nobody opposed it.
It just incredible. I mean, this man really wanted to be a man of the people, and Chile turned from that kind of a system to just a horrific, a despotic system under Allende, and that lasted about 17 years or so. And Chile today, with its neoliberal poison, is harming people in its own way. And there were protests that happened in Chile ongoing, on and off, because of all the horrors going on there. So Chile has never had a moment of peace, you can say, since Allende. And this is what can happen, and it's happening in America. I like to say, John, that America never was a democracy, and it sure as hell isn't one now, but it is really sinking deep, deep down to terrible depths it's never plunged to before, and we're literally right on the cusp of full-blown tyranny, where I would think if there's any momentous event, like another state-sponsored terror attack, a mega false flag, maybe even bigger than 9/11, you're going to see martial law declared, you're going to see the Constitution suspended. And we got a taste of it, John, in Boston, because of the bombings that were false flags. So those bombings that went off, and the two brothers that were charged, one murdered in cold blood, the other miraculously survived. He spoke to his mother at the end of May. I mentioned this a couple of times on this program. He said, I don't know why they let him do it, but the London Telegraph, the UK Daily Telegraph, published what he said. He told his mother, "We had nothing to do with it."
Wow.
And I believe him. They had nothing to do with it. They were framed. One brother's dead. He's going to spend the rest of his life in prison. That's the U.S. system. And what happened in Boston, John, was Boston was under martial law, no rights, nothing, for I don't know how many hours, a day or two, till they found the second brother. And literally, there were cops, there were National Guard, there were FBI, drug enforcement agents, who else? Who knows who else, rousting innocent people out of their homes pre-dawn, demanding to go and breaking in if they wouldn't let them in, and literally people could have been shot for non-cooperation. That's what a police state looks like, and what happened in Boston is going to happen again somewhere, and it could happen nationwide, and it might happen sooner than we think.
I agree. And at the same time, perhaps making it darker is it's a cumulative process, and every stitch of the police state is being, another stitch is being sawn as we speak. It's not as if suddenly things are going to change into the police state. They are already sowing towards an ever more complete police state. And as always, the method of blaming terrorists, reverse projection for what you do yourself, is the reason for the attack, the reason for the subjugation. But unlike any other empire in the past, and sorry to keep coming back to the model, but what joins all these things that are happening to every country on the face of the earth? A massive privatization of the resources, which are public resources. The ever cheaper labor, and I'm just remembering from your own listing, the labor at ever cheaper price and more insecure and less of it. Not even unions permitted anymore, basically. Deregulation, that continuous deregulation, but deregulation in a way is misleading because it's always a re-regulation. They're always deregulating from life protective norms and law and regulations. They're always deregulating from the life protective to the absolutist rights of transnational corporate money sequences. And only their rights. Every single trade agreement, everything that goes on conforms to that single defining principle. You've also referred to corporate friendly tax cuts. Indeed, corporate friendly tax cuts. You have a way of understating it nicely. Corporate friendly, they're going to zero from, in fact, they're going to net assets. They're giving the corporations more money than they get. They're getting net benefits out of the taxation system with the subsidies being given to them. And as you say, I mean, the corporate friendly isn't just towards the corporations themselves, which are, you know, shell bodies that have many aliases and move around just like a cancer inside the body with no committed life function to anything, pay no taxes and so on. And then you have where you have a marginalized working class itself. And again, I'm quoting your list when you gave in your last article on Syria and really what they're just doing over and over and over again, this same framework, which is euphemized as neoliberalism. They, you know, it's not just marginalizing, it's destroying the working class in every possible way, destroying it by its livelihood, destroying it by its life security, destroying it by its pensions, destroying it by its benefits, destroying it by its unions, destroying every capacity of life it has. This is what it always does. You look at everything this system does, it's life capacity destructive. That's how you tell what it is. That's how you recognize it and try to find exceptions to it. It's always doing that because that's what it is. You mentioned speculative capital flows. Well, indeed, speculative capital flows, inflows come into the country, but many more speculative capital flows go out of the country. They come into the country to break it, and they go out of the country once they've got their profit and leave it exhausted and broken. And what the biggest speculative capital inflow is, it's not really, it's the reverse of a capital inflow. It's a capital take through the debt mechanism, the private bank debt mechanism system, which multiplies money owed by the, as you pay it back, so you end up owing as the third world, six times more than you've already paid back, which is more than the debt itself, which itself was commissioned under terms where the loaners of the money never had the money to back their debts to begin with, but only depend on the debt payments for it. So all of that, every single one of those things joins together. There's only one diagnostic model that applies, that subsumes, that is adequate to all these phenomena. What unifies them? Nothing else does. And, of course, jobless recoveries, other things you mentioned, same thing. No function, no productive function, nothing for life necessities being built. Basically, the life necessities, insofar as we're providing them for them, we're degrading them, we're spoiling them, like, say, food itself or the air we breathe. They're being spoiled, despoiled, degraded, adulterated. We're not getting life means are collapsing at all levels. And, of course, that's a standard characteristic of a cancer system at any level. It robs the host of its nutriments one way or another. And so we have the perhaps, which you mention again and again, and you're absolutely right, this is to me the worst of all the things perhaps, is that our next generations, our youth, have no future. They don't have a vocation. Imagine thinking back to when we were young looking for a job and so forth, and of course it was, you know, you could find a job if you're willing to work, and almost everybody is, you need to work. They're as it were a superannuated generation. They've got no function. Well, you give a youth no function, and that youth is going to either feel suicidal or go off the rails one way or another. And indeed, the suicide rates have multiplied, and they continue to go. And of course, only the lucky ones are able to get a job, because all the jobs, what are the jobs? The jobs are service jobs. And what are the service jobs providing? They're providing junk. So every way you cut it,
John, you can come out of school now with a master's or a PhD that may happen to be in the wrong field, quote unquote, and be unable to find a job.
I don't think there is a right field anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. But you go back a few decades, and there were many jobs. Well, so many of the good ones have been offshored to cheap labor countries, and what's left in America, as you say, these low-pay, poor-benefit service jobs. This is the future that young people have to look forward to today. It wasn't that way when we were growing up, John.
No. So how are you going to keep the lid on all this, Steve? You've got to build up the military and the police. You've got to build up the prisons. You've got to take away the civil rights. What's happened? Every one of them.
Well, they're getting ready, John. They have concentration camps called FEMA camps ready. They've purchased, I don't know how many billions of rounds of ammunition just ready for the uprisings to show up in various cities. And when they show up, John, they're usually nonviolent. It's the cops that turn violent.
Oh, well, that's
always been the case.
These
are the ones that do it. But sooner or later, there's going to be a pain threshold crossed at some point, John, if things get bad enough. My threshold is when families can't feed their kids anymore. That happens, if they take away food stamps and the food banks simply can't supply enough food to everybody who needs them because the poverty just keeps expanding exponentially, and when parents can't feed their children and they're scared to death that their kids could perish, I think that's the threshold that we really could see some big stuff.
Well, yeah, and I'm afraid it's being reached. And the problem, I have an old nightmare, and the nightmare is that this system being inherently evil by the principles that govern it, which are cancerous, is being a cancer. It doesn't care about its life host. You know, it only dies off when it kills its host. It's almost strategically waiting for the chance, almost as if its breath is panting to get a shot at just mowing down all the helpless people. That the system has become so twisted that it is into an automatic kind of pilot to lust for it. And I even think, and you may disagree with me here, I even think that your president, Obama, I think he himself is trapped inside this system. And if he doesn't behave, because I've long thought the U.S., and of course it's only become truer and truer, the U.S. can only, it has a motto, we kill, therefore we are. I kill, therefore I am. That's always been its motto. That's what makes it number one. It's number one in nothing in the world now. It's number 26, number 30 on all the things that count, whether your babies survive, whether your children are nutritionally supplied, whether your education system provides for all, whether you're, et cetera. It leads in none of them. It just keeps dropping lower and lower and lower, even on in things like a mother's survival of birth. It drops lower and lower and lower. It's only good at one thing, and this is something I've been going on about for some years since the cancer system got underway. It only identifies with killing. That's the one thing, the only thing it comes together, the American civilization as we now know it, it's the only thing that the people come together over, killing other people, including your own, because they might be subversives or whatever. And I remember thinking when Clayton Powell got all that support as a presidential candidate, and I thought at that time, gee, that's interesting, he's a black guy. But he satisfied the one thing that counts to the overriding electorate of America. He satisfies the criterion, we kill, therefore we are. He was quite willing to kill defenseless soldiers in the tens of thousands, just shoot them down like dogs or worse, in the desert fleeing Iraqi soldiers. And he was asked, well, did it bother you to kill, I think it was 90,000 people? He said, no, I didn't really think about it. In fact, that gave him his cachet. That gave him his gun in the OK Corral. That gave him his American identity. And the American identity has now become, and it's even obvious in its sports. You notice how the sports are all collected together around martial displays now?
And
more, it's all a martial display, and it's a martial game. It's run like, you know, there's field generals and long bombs, and it's all military language. And what we've seen this thing, I've watched this thing grow and grow and grow and grow until it has become automatic pilot. It's built right into the system. And a guy like Obama, who's not a strong backboned man, he's caught inside it. And that he may actually, you know, whereas others would have, like the Republicans in a moment, would go in and bomb. They'd like to go in and bomb Iraq. It turns them on. He's a little more, still has enough human sense to recognize the disaster of that.
I wish we could hear that, John. that music is plug-pulling music. John, I look forward to getting you back next month. There's so much more to talk about. This stuff never ends. The topics are very big, very important, and we certainly need to do something about it. I don't say that lightly. I work at it every day. You do, John. I hope listeners take it seriously. Everybody has loved ones. We need to protect them because the government, sir, isn't going to do it. John, many, many thanks.
Thank you, D.
Join us again next week, Fridays, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.